Look up idiot in the dictionary. You know what you'll find?
A picture of me?
No! The definition of the word idiot, which you fucking are!
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to I Do Movies Badly, a podcast exploration of my cinematic ignorance. I'm your host, Jim Rohner, and despite being an amateur film critic since 2006, I am woefully ignorant of many films, filmmakers, and genres that consensus has deemed important. And thus I have created this podcast to document my journey into cinematic edification. This month I'm exploring the films of Andrew Arnold, as recommended by Jenny Miller, contributor to Bust. And this week's episode I'll be talking about Andrew Arnold's 2009 film, Fish Tank. Fish Tank is, as you are, I'm sure, aware, having watched it yourself, a great film. If you remember from Red Road last week, I was kind of lukewarm. I'll be honest, my heart and my mind weren't fully in the recording of the episode due to a few things that were distracting me, but also just with some retrospect, it just Red Road didn't really resonate with me. I mean, certainly I will stand by the statement that I made, in which Red Road is a signifier of a strong, assured director who has a vision of what she is trying to do and how she is trying to accomplish it. But it's one that I saw and it was fine, and I'm probably never going to watch it again, and I probably wouldn't really recommend it to anybody. But if someone stumbled upon it, I'd be like, oh yeah, cool, I saw that one too, and I thought it was okay. Fish Tank is a different story. Fish Tank, I thought, was a great film and was one of those that I was really into it as I was watching it. And then, you know, a few hours after I was done, the next day I was done, a couple days later after I was done, was reflecting on it and really thought, oh my God, this is a really great film. But one of those, and this has happened a few times here on I Do Movies Badly, one of those films which is like, this is great, and I don't know who I would recommend it to, because it is, I don't even want to say it's an uncomfortable watch. There are certainly parts of it which are uncomfortable, but there is a tone to it and a style to it which I think most people would be made uncomfortable by, or wouldn't resonate with them. And I think that, as I was thinking back, and I think it has to do with the objectivity that Andrew Arnold brings to the characters in the film and the world that these characters inhabit. It would be inaccurate to, or I think it would be inaccurate to describe Fish Tank as having a documentary feel or an avant-garde feel, if you want to use that term, for you film school students out there. But I also think it would be equally as inaccurate to say that the film is trying to manipulate you in some way, trying to make you feel a certain way. Certainly, there is a protagonist, Mia, who is played by, what is her name? I scribbled her name down here. Hang on just a minute. Katie Jarvis. Mia, as played by Katie Jarvis, certainly she is the main character. Andrew Arnold wants us to relate to her. She is one, clearly the one that is going through a development, a narrative arc. So we want to sympathize with her, and we do sympathize with her, or empathize with her, or relate to her, we connect with her. So we're supposed to be invested in that story, but I don't think that Andrea Arnold... this is tough. I'm gonna have to try and get over this... this idea of a filmmaker that has two first names, it throws me off, but I don't think that Arnold wants us to necessarily feel one way or another about her, or about the characters that are around her, or about the world that she lives in, which I know is a little bit of a strange thing to say, considering some of the things that do end up happening to Mia, or some of the things that Mia ends up doing in the film, and we'll certainly get into that, but from my perspective, sitting and watching Fish Tank, what I see instead is just sort of Andrew Arnold creating a world, and that is, of course, the world of British estate housing. You may know it, in America, it's kind of a, you know, project housing, low-income housing. She creates this world and these characters who inhabit it, and then she just kind of is like, hey, this is how things are. This is how these characters are. This is how they live. This is how they go about in their daily basis. I mean, you don't really... It's sort of implied, or at least you kind of pick up on the sense that there is something a little bit off until you find out about halfway through the film that Mia has been thrown out of school. The reason that she has never seen doing anything except for generally causing trouble and engaging in her passion of dance is that because she has nowhere to go during the day because she was thrown out of school. So there's that, but it's presented in such a way where it's not a major dramatic point in the film. It's just kind of it, but it's not an afterthought either. It is just the reveal of that is one way to get her out of the apartment to lead towards something else in the film. It's not like, oh my God, she's been thrown out of school, but it's not thrown in her face in any sort of way. It's just like, hey, that's who she is. That's what happened. And really, from one of the very first scenes in which she is watching a few girls go through a dance routine in the park, a hip-hop dance routine in the park, and she says that their dancing is shit and headbutts one of the girls in the face, that's who she is. That's what this film is going to be. It's going to be pretty much in your face, and it's just going to be unapologetic for what is going to be on display. And so, you know, I can certainly see how people could watch this and just from the filthy language. Oh man, I just felt like an old person saying that filthy language. From the language which may upset some people, including coming from very young children, to the habits that some of these characters participate in, you know, smoking and underage drinking and all that kind of stuff, to the neglect that we see from Mia's mom, from the quarreling and the clashes that she has with her sister, and just the fact that she is kind of a easily upsettable girl who doesn't seem to have many friends and want to open up to people, that's just kind of all there. And I don't think that there's really no tricks or no ploys that Arnold has to kind of make us or shows that she wants us to feel one way or another about the fact that this is it. I mean, she just kind of lays all the cards on the table. It's like, hey, these are the people that I'm going to make this film about. Play the hand or don't. Those are my terms, and you kind of have to accept those. And if you're not willing to accept those, or you're just you have a preconceived notion, or you just, well, I don't think that kids should be acting like this. I don't think that movie should be like this. And I would prefer it if you know, if these characters were a little bit more likable or a little bit more easily accessible, then you're not going to be able to connect with this film. But once again, getting back to this idea of engaging with the film on its terms, I was able to engage with the film on its terms. It didn't turn me off, and I think it was a great film and a great experience because of it. I think this is helped by the fact that we have some really strong performances really across the board in this movie. Admittedly, it's a very small cast, but some great performances, the two of which, of course, at the center of it are Katie Jarvis, who plays Mia, and Michael Fassbender, who plays Connor, who is the boyfriend of Mia's mom. And there are two very different characters, but the fact that they are drawn together emotionally, psychologically, and in the narrative sort of makes sense. It seems a little off-putting at first until some vulnerability comes in there, until these characters start to change and the characters start to open and you understand how they could be drawn to each other. Mia, or Katie Jarvis, I should say, was a non-professional actor, had never acted in anything before until a casting director saw her on a train platform arguing with her boyfriend. Jenny talked about this in an introductory episode. I believe at the time that this film was shot, she was 16. By the time it had come out, she was 18 and had been given birth to a daughter that was conceived with the boy that she was yelling at. And I don't bring that up in order to kind of talk about it as, ooh, look at how edgy Andrea Arnold is. You know, she cast these non-professional actors, and it's great that she cast a girl who is just like the girl that was going to be playing in her movie. You know, I don't think it's nothing to do with breaking convention or trying to be a contrarian for anything like that, but I think there is a real vulnerability on display in Fish Tank, specifically from the Mia character, and I think it says something about Andrea Arnold that she was able to, one, see a girl who she saw a lot of herself in. I mean, Jenny talked about it in the introductory episode, how this was sort of the environment that Andrea Arnold was raised in, so just being able to see you know, kind of a surrogate of this story in this girl who had lived probably a lot of the life that she was used to. So she was able to see, like, okay, if I'm going to tell a story in which I need a character to immediately, that an audience is immediately going to relate to, that is going to be able to let people know what it's like to be this type of person, to live in this kind of world, that's a smart move, casting someone like, well, why not cast someone who is actually from that world, who actually knows what it is all about? But then it also, because of the vulnerability that's on display here, it's also good to have someone who is going to be genuinely vulnerable, because this is going to be, just in making this film, it is going to be a new experience for them, really, from, you know, the very first minute that she calls action to when the film is wrapped. This is all going to be a brand new experience for her, not just in regards to, oh wow, this is what it's like to make a film and this is kind of weird to get used to, but also in the sense of, okay, here are some really challenging emotions that you need to explore. Now, what is that like? I mean, I can't even imagine what it's like to have to open up to what this character or what this actress opens up to in this film. And so I think it was a brilliant move on the part of Andrew Arnold to cast an unknown, because in a way it's kind of perfect, because, you know, what Mia is going through, she is a young girl, she's 15 years old in the film. She is an unknown. Everything about this girl's life is an unknown, from, you know, her first sexual experience with a guy to her second sexual experience with a guy, to just this idea of wanting to get out and wanting to see what the world is like outside of this small little world that she lives in. Everything for a teenager is an unknown. When you combine that with the fact that the way this film was shot the actors were not given the full script ahead of time. I believe that they were given the pages, if not the day of shooting or the day before shooting, then shortly before things were being shot. And what I think, what that brings, and that's a risky move, because it can add something to your film or can actively distract from your film, depending on who your cast is, who the crew that you've assembled are. I think it paid off in spades here, because, once again, getting back to the idea of a vulnerability, of an uncertainty, of an unknown, how else, you know, what's a great way that you can kind of cull that from your actors, that you can kind of bring that out? It's like, well, don't let them know what they're getting into until they are on the precipice of getting into it. And of course, Michael Fassbender being Michael Fassbender, who is a wonderful and, let's be honest, gorgeous man, that's besides the point, but being a wonderful actor, it's fascinating to see how he responds to that, or how he plays with that. And it's also fascinating to see how Katie Jarvis responds to that as well, because what I feel like that lends to the film is, once again, an idea of uncertainty, of not being sure what those next steps are going to be, whether physically or figuratively, of not being sure how the scene is going to unfold, especially when it is something which is intimate and tense and uncomfortable, and there's sort of a not a shock, but there is a curiosity and a naivety. I always have trouble pronouncing that word. But that is really, that you see on the faces of Mia and that you see on the face of Connor. And I think that comes from somewhere genuine, because it seems like the first time that they are playing out on film is the first time that they're even trying to play out these things in general. And so when it comes to something like a sex scene, especially a sex scene involving a teenage girl, what is that going to lend to the emotion of that, of the interplay between these two characters? What I think it lends is a genuineness and a real uncertainty of, I'm not really entirely sure why I'm doing this, which, let's be honest, how many of us can relate to that specific mind thought process when you're in the moment of something which is so emotionally charged and maybe illogical as a sexual experience? You find yourself in the middle of it, kind of being unable to step outside yourself. You are aware of, like, okay, I'm doing something. I'm not entirely sure why I'm doing this. This doesn't seem like a smart idea, but I'm going to continue forward with doing that. Now, the benefit of having actors do that is that they are moving forward with it because of sort of a mandate. Like, well, I'm told that I have to do this. But that doesn't make it any more certain than someone who is caught up in the emotional throes of sexual intimacy, you know? And so there is this genuine uncertainty that comes out in these emotionally charged scenes, which I think is wonderful, and which I think is accented by the fact that you have a non-professional actor in your as your lead, and you have given the script pages to her maybe the day of filming. So I think it's a wonderful move, and not necessarily because of, oh, look at how contrarian Andrea Arnold is, look at her trying to break convention and trying to do something hip and cool and edgy. I think it plays perfectly into the film that she is making and the story that she is trying to tell. Now, once again, hammering on, I'm going to say this a lot, but this idea of vulnerability, because this is something, this is the reason that I connected so much with this film, this idea of how this girl who seemed so inaccessible was putting her vulnerabilities on display, and the interplay or the exploration of how those things come about and how that is taken advantage of is so so heartbreaking and so intense for me. But before we get into the really heavy stuff, I want to talk about one scene that I really responded to. Clearly, Mia is a dancer. She loves dancing. That is her passion. And it's something that she is encouraged by Connor to do. He thinks that she's great. And he's it's interesting because you just get the sense of this is something that she has to herself, that she uses as an escape, as a coping mechanism, sort of as evidenced by the fact that when she is working on her routine, she goes to an empty apartment, breaks in the door, puts her headphones or speakers on and just dances when no one is around, where no one can see her. And in fact, she seems to be very, especially around her family, her little sister and her mother, she is especially hesitant to kind of open up that way, because that's a vulnerable thing. You know, that is something that's like, it's a peek inside your soul. Like, this is what I care about. This is what I love. And if you've been hurt by someone, especially if you have been hurt by someone who is close to you, you are even more unwilling, or I should say the walls are up, the walls are higher and thicker. You don't want to let someone in because you don't want to be hurt. Well, how can you be hurt by someone? Show them who you are, open up to them, show them your soul, show them your passion, show them your love, show them what you love, and have them be critical of it, have them respond negatively to it. That's how you can really hurt somebody. And so there's this great scene, you can stab them too, but I'm talking more emotionally, I suppose. So there's this great scene where the family has all taken sort of an impromptu day trip. Initially it was supposed to just be Connor and Mia's mother, and then I guess just out of spite, Mia and her young sister decide to, yeah, we want to come along too. So they go on this drive, they find this field, they catch a fish. And then while they're sort of waiting in a parking lot, a rest stop or a stop along the way, Mia's mom is off getting drinks, and Connor puts a song on the radio and says, "Here, let me show me a dance to this one." And so Mia kind of has to be talked into it, but she eventually starts dancing, and it's all very amicable. It's all very friendly. There's kind of, dare I say it, sort of a hint of joy in the scene, but. The sun is shining and you know, people have had a good day, and it's just, it's a, the mood and the vibes are very positive, and you kind of start feeling hopeful about Mia opening up, and Mia opening up to this guy who seems like he's a very genuine guy, who seems like he could be a real friend or a real mentor, but a real positive influence in her life. And so she starts dancing and she's getting into it, and she, dare I say, she cracks a smile. Connor certainly seems to be enjoying it. He starts dancing as well. And all of a sudden, Mia's mom shows up with drinks in her hand. And she starts laughing and she starts criticizing. Not anything that's really hostile, but it's certainly something that's just like, oh, come on, this shit again. Let's be serious about this. And then in a heartbeat, Mia turns. And she is immediately sour about it. She's immediately cranky. And she starts screaming at Connor, "Who the fuck are you? You know, what do you think? We're best friends now." And she storms off. And it seems like it's something that could just be like, oh, the hormones of teenagers, and oh, they, you know, their mood, you know, it's at the drop of a hat, her, you know, that's sort of the perception of teenagers. But what I really loved about that scene was how it spoke to the conflict that was within Mia, of this idea of like, here's someone who I'm sort of starting to maybe open up to and that I can perhaps share with. And then her mom, someone who has been a source of hurt from the past, all of a sudden infringes upon this little wonderful moment, this moment of her opening up. And then all of a sudden it's sort of like the ink is mixing with like, you know, the mixing into the water and tainting it and making it dark. And that's why she storms off. She doesn't storm off because she's a volatile teenager. She storms off because it's like, I wanted to share something with this person and you ruined it. I wanted to be vulnerable and you made me feel bad about it. And that's why she storms off. And I responded to that scene so hard. I mean, that was sort of like, oh my God, yes, yes, yes. And it's so... maybe because it's something that I can relate to in the sense of being a little bit hesitant to open up to people about certain things that I'm into, and certainly having things like thrown back in my face. That's something that I can relate to. I think all of us can relate to a certain degree. But if you haven't, then I think that scene sort of just strikes out as like, that was weird. What's wrong with that girl? But for me, I love that scene, and that was something that stuck out to me. Like as really as one of those like, oh my God, is this really a film being told by a filmmaker who knows these characters so well, who knows sort of I don't want to say the human condition, that sounds like such a pretentious, grandiose bullshit phrase, but who knows what it's like to be this kind of person, to grow up with a certain form of being disadvantaged. Not just financially or superficially, but also just emotionally disadvantaged as well. Which, of course, leads me into the thing that we have to talk about next, which is the sex scene between Mia and Connor. And this scene, guys and girls, this scene broke my heart. It was something that... half my brain saw coming, and the other half of my brain was just like, no, this, you're, shut up, other half, because you are just filling in something. You have preconceived notions because of too much other shit that you've seen, and it was just, and there was a real tension watching this scene unfold. And the way, there are so many clues leading up to that scene, or I should say in that sequence, there are so many clues like, yeah, they are going to have sex. But I really didn't want them to. I mean, just the way that it's lit with, you know, a dark room, and the way that Connor is looking at her, and the way that she is, in a way, performing for him, and just how the only light in the entire room is this not even harsh, but this yellow-orangey street light, which sort of casts an odd, eerie glow, like in the room. There's a definite, the way that it's crafted, there's definitely a building sexual tension, which sort of starts low but then slowly builds up as she dances, and as those moments of silence, or the silence in between words and actions, start to just sit there and not fester, but as they just sort of sit there and they the tension builds. And I had been watching this film, and I had been watching the relationship between Mia and Connor unfold, and just daring and wanting to hope and think that here's a guy which is going to be a great influence for her. Here's a guy who's really going to be able to help her out, who's going to be a father figure for her. And as the dance, as she was dancing for him and kind of showing him the routine that she had dreamt up with, the routine that she had planned and that she was showing to him, and then watching as the camera would cut back and forth between her dancing and the way that he was just lounging on the couch and looking at her, and I just thought, no, please do not introduce sex into this. And I wasn't saying that to Andrea Arnold. I wasn't saying, like, no, don't ruin this scene, don't ruin this. I was just thinking, like, what is happening and what has been happening is so positive and so pure. Please do not ruin that by violating her trust and introducing sex into it. And that is, of course, exactly what happens. And it occurred to me as I was watching the scene, I had the benefit of being not a participant, but of just being an objective third party spectator, that what I was watching was a scene of abuse, was a scene of emotional abuse, not hostility, not of something that was certainly consensual, but was certainly a scene of emotional abuse in the sense of Connor had done so many things to build up this girl's trust. Was it clear that she was attracted to him? Yes. But he had done so much to build up her trust, and then he violates that trust by really crossing the lines of her vulnerability and taking physical advantage of her when he was not in the right mental state being drunk, and she was also in not in the right mental state being underage and not being able to fully process and conceive of the implications of what was or of what could have happened from that. You know, abuse and specifically sexual abuse and domestic abuse doesn't always take such a black and white form as, oh, he was punching me in the face, or, you know, there was a screaming match and bottles were being thrown back and forth. It sometimes takes the form of, or I should say, it sometimes is introduced or is proliferated through acts which on the surface appear to be or come across to the abuser or abused, I should say, as what seems to be love and affection. Now, do I believe that Connor's character was malicious? No. Do I believe that he was a pedophile? No. But he certainly participated in an action which, seeing as how Mia was already in a volatile, uncertain, emotionally unsettled state, he participated in an action which, years down the line, could have real consequences to not allowing her to be trustful and to be opened up again, because her mind, consciously or unconsciously, would associate, when I open up, this is what happens. And I think why that was such a clear thought to me was partially due to how well, like I said, Arnold crafts these characters and crafts these stories in this world that they live in. But also, I was watching the film in close proximity in terms of, I think, just a day after I had watched a screener of a documentary that played at Sundance. I believe it was an audience prize winner, a grand jury prize winner for docs at Sundance called Pervert Park. And it's all about a community in Florida of mobile homes. And the entire population, or I should say the entire park, is populated by people who are registered sex offenders and who cannot live within a certain distance of areas where kids regularly congregate. And that's schools, that's parks, that's churches. And the individual stories that these people tell, the way that they have gotten to the point of abusing a minor, all starts out with having themselves first been abused. Abuse creates a cycle, and a cycle that perpetuates. You cannot change abuse with abuse. You cannot fight fire with fire. Only love can do that. And I think because I had seen that film just the day before and these stories were fresh in my mind of these people who started out one way, who started out pure and innocent and trusting and had that trust violated, that was a catalyst which, if not the primary cause, and most of them they'd say were not the primary cause, but certainly was a a catalyst that got them to a point where they were eventually in a position to take advantage of somebody else's trust. That's what I was seeing in this sex scene in Fish Tank. And it was such a subversion of expectations for me, because earlier in the film, there's a scene where Connor lifts a sleeping Mia off the couch and brings her upstairs and puts her in bed. And we see the camera from Mia's kind of POV as he takes her shoes off one at a time and then slides her pants off too. And you just think, oh my God, please don't let him do it. Please don't let him do it. And he doesn't. Instead, what he does is after he slides her pants off, he puts the covers over her and puts her to bed. And you kind of think, oh my God, this is going to be different. This guy is going to be different than, despite the fact that we haven't seen or heard of any other male character in this girl's life, this guy is going to be different from them. Because look at the gesture he just made for her. And so that was in my mind as the sex scene began to unfold. And I thought, no, maybe my mind is just going there because I was trained to think that based on other films that I saw or other sequences which played on a similar way, he's a good guy. He's not going to do this. And then he does it. And I don't want to say that I would be able to completely understand someone who is in that same situation. But at least for the Mia character, for the way that Arnold has told this story and told me about this woman and let me into her life, I was as close to, I think, understanding the consequences and the fallout from such an act as I possibly could be. And that is a testament to Arnold as a filmmaker. I think I wish I wrote or I came up with this thought myself, but in Roger Ebert's review of Fish Tank, he says, but Fish Tank in any event isn't so much about sex as about the helpless spiral Mia is going through. And that's right on. I mean, here's a girl who is hurting, who is unable to trust someone, and when she finally does, this is what happens. And I think because of that scene, because of a build-up to that, you do see, as I said, abuse perpetuates abuse. How does she return the fact that Connor does that and then ditches the family and goes back home to what turns out to be his home with a wife and a child? She returns it with abuse. She essentially kidnaps his daughter. It's done without really sort of a clear explanation. She never says why she's doing it. She just does it. And at first when it's happening, when she lures her away and like, hey, your mom told me to help you to come and get ice cream with me, so come on. And then she goes and they start walking through fields, and eventually the girl starts going like, I want to go home. I don't like you. You're scaring me. What's going on? And you're just like, oh my God, quit being a fucking psychopath and bring the girl back. And your natural reaction is the kind of thing like, Mia, you are an asshole. You are a scumbag. What you're doing is fucking terrible. And of course it is. And I'm not saying that this justifies it or that it negates it, but she was also emotionally taken advantage of by this guy. How was she supposed to respond to it? Once again, I'm not saying that because Connor did X, then it justifies Y and Z on Mia's part, but it's just abuse perpetuates abuse. What did you think was going to happen? What did you think? How did you think she was going to respond? And because of all that shit that happens, I think that it makes one of the very end scenes, the dance audition scene, so fucking good and so fucking powerful that, of course, because Mia has this passion, because she devotes so much of her time to dancing, she eventually gets this audition, and we're kind of excited for her because, like, great, she's got an audition, but we're not really sure what the audition is for. We have a sense of, like, maybe it's not something that's entirely legit, but you still kind of hope, like, yeah, maybe this is going to be her, you know, her figurative big break, or the thing that's finally going to get her out of this system, this world. And then she shows up to the audition, and we see right away, oh, shit, this is an audition for exotic dancing, for stripping, for dancing that is, let's say, less than respectable in many circles. And there's a tension once again where she's sitting there waiting for her turn to come up, and she's watching this blonde woman on stage doing these very erotic maneuvers, and we kind of see people who are the women who are scantily clad women who are seating around her, kind of putting their makeup on and taking various items of clothing off, and she's sitting there in her her track pants and her hooded sweatshirt, and she's not dolled up at all because her routine is a hip hop dance routine. And she's called up, and they call her name, and you kind of wonder, like, oh, is she maybe not going to get up there? And then she, sure enough, gets out of her chair, and she goes up to walk up the stage. She gives the CD to the DJ, and she gets up there, and they say, can you put your hair down? She puts her hair down, and the song starts. And there's a pause, because she doesn't start dancing right away, and you kind of think, like, okay, this is a pivotal moment right here. Where if she starts dancing, if she gives into it, that's sort of it. We kind of get the impression that that is it for her. If she gives into that, if she takes the thing that she loves, if she takes her passion, if she takes her vulnerability and lets it be taken advantage of, or lets it be twisted and poisoned and tainted for somebody else, for an audience, for someone who is not her, you just get the sense of there is no going back for her. That's sort of the end of the line. Not even the end of the line. That's sort of the point of no return. If she takes what she loves and she gives it away and doesn't keep it sacred for herself, then she's essentially given up her soul. And so having the film build up to that moment to have Arnold positioning the camera behind Mia, where we don't see her face, where we just kind of see her framed instead, center, kind of out on this open space, where you're kind of like, you get the impression like she has everything in front of her now. What is she going to do? When she hops off stage and runs out with even getting the dispatch, just Caden and Gab getting the fuck out, I'm like, oh my god, yes, that was amazing, that was wonderful, that was so empowering, that was so fucking awesome. That she saw that she had her future in front of her, in her hand, and she chose not to give it away. She chose not to taint it. She chose for once to be proactive in her own life, to take charge of her own life. And I loved that. I loved that moment so much. You have no idea how much I love that moment. And that leads then to her deciding to pack up and go to Wales with a boy that she met earlier on in the film, who had a horse. That was a whole thing, which I still don't really fully understand. But hey, there was a half-baked romance subplot that developed between these two characters. And while I know nothing about that guy, the film doesn't tell us much about that guy. It's still just enough, like, okay, at least that's a vehicle for her to get out of here, to take a trip, to go to Wales, to see something which is outside of her own world. Outside of her own fish tank, perhaps? Because a little while ago, Jenny Miller and I were having a brief conversation about, like, what do you think about the title Fish Tank? Because you certainly assume that with such a title, there is going to be something which is maybe pretty obvious or pretty blatant about why it's called that. Red Road was called so because the male character, whose name is escaping me now, his project where he lived was on Red Road. And Fish Tank, yeah, there's a scene where they catch a fish in a river or a pond or stream, whatever you want to call it. Lake? I don't know. Pond? Whatever. Stream? It was a stream. Let's call it a stream. But then after they catch that fish, it's sort of forgotten. It's never really brought up again. When you do see it again, the fish is on the floor and the dog is eating it. So there's something significant about that scene, but not so much about the fish itself. And then doing some research online, it seems like the general consensus seems to be that this estate that she lives in, or even on a bigger scale, just this world of this low-income housing, this broken home, this neglect, this world that she lives in, she has never gone outside of it geographically or emotionally. She's kind of been inside her own world, kind of looking out. This world that Arnold has crafted for us is sort of Mia's own fish tank. She's sort of stuck in it, and she's never been able to get out before. And that seems to certainly be reinforced by the really interesting decision to shoot in 4x3. Seeing as it was 2009 and HD capabilities were a bit more advanced than they were in 2006 when Red Road came out. Arnold could have certainly afforded to shoot on 16:9 in a widescreen format. But she chose not to, and I think it's smart for two reasons. One, because it does, yes, on the surface, it does sort of enhance this idea of, oh, she's stuck, she's sort of in prison. There's only so much in the frame that we can see. There's only so much in the frame where Mia can inhabit. But I think it also adds, the second thing sort of adds this idea of, we know that there's more outside the frame, but we're not allowed to see it. As viewers, we're not allowed to see it. It is withheld from us. Sort of like for a character who is raised in this world, we know that there's more stuff out there. There's a nicer TV out there. There's a nicer car out there. There's a nicer couch. There's a nicer apartment out there. But they're not allowed to have it. And this is going to be a weird comment, but it was almost kind of like... The 4x3 made sense because this world couldn't afford the 16x9. That's how I thought of it, at least. So, Fish Tank, that is all that I have for Fish Tank. It is very easily available to you if you have not seen it, or based on this film podcast that you just listened to, if you want to see it again. It is available for rental or purchase on Amazon. It is available for rental or purchase on iTunes. It is available for rental or purchase on Google Play. It is available for rental on YouTube. But if you don't want to spend money, it is available for free on Netflix, which, despite having been discussed with Jenny in the introductory episode, I completely forgot until just now when I went to sit down and record this episode and thought, great, so I didn't need to spend the money to rent it from Amazon because I was already paying for my Netflix subscription. So, listeners, do not make the same mistake that I did. First and foremost, go to Netflix and you can stream it there for free. But if you don't have Netflix, plenty of other ways for you to get your hands on it. And super cheaply too, and highly recommended. I must absolutely say that. So, yeah, that's it for Fish Tank. I always want to hear from you, of course. So please do feel free to shoot me an email over at youdomoviesbadly@gmail.com. Find the latest episodes or all back episodes too for I Do Movies Badly on my Facebook page, which is facebook.com/IDomoviesbadly. You can also find my podcast on iTunes, where I would love it if you would leave me a rating. Or you can go to battleshipretention.com, go to the podcast drop-down menu, and go to I Do Movies Badly, and you can leave comments under those episodes as well. Also, if you are so inclined, you can find me on Twitter at NolanFixesTeeth, though often I don't tweet anything which is relevant to the podcast. It's mainly me tweeting random lines, obscure lines from TV shows and movies that randomly pop in my head. But if you find me on there and you recognize one of those lines, tweet at me. Maybe we can develop some type of friendship. We can become best friends forever. But yeah, that does it for this episode. That does it for Fish Tank. Be sure to tune in next week, where I will be wrapping up Andrea Arnold with Wuthering Heights, and hopefully I'll be just a little bit less ignorant.
This program is a proud member of the Battleship Pretension Fleet.